Welcome to Radio Sefarad's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sefarad's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world. Our trivia question for this week is, why did many Jews in the Aragon region of Spain convert to Christianity voluntarily even before the Inquisition was a threat? Edith Scott Saavedra earned a Bachelor of Arts, magna cum laude, from Harvard University, where she studied Spanish literature with Professor Juan Marichal. While an undergraduate at Harvard, she also studied political philosophy, history, and social theory. Ms. Scott also earned a Juris Doctor cum laude from the Harvard Law School. She's had a distinguished career as an international lawyer, business consultant, and author. She's the co-author of several leading nonfiction works on the competitiveness of industries, regions, and nations. Ms. Scott has recently switched gears and published The Lamps of Albarracín, a historical novel set in the region of Aragon in the northeast of Spain at the time of the Spanish Inquisition. The author herself describes this work as being in the tradition of the Portuguese saudade, a story of nostalgic longing for a past that witnessed interfaith friendships as well as enmity, in a society in which members of the three religions, Christian, Jewish, and Muslim, lived in the same locality and interacted with each other in their daily lives. The book has been published simultaneously in English and Spanish. Thank you very much for speaking with us today, Edith.
First, I'd like to ask you about yourself, about your own personal background, where you're from, your profession, that kind of thing.
I grew up in Washington, D.C. I graduated from Harvard University with 2 degrees, undergraduate and law. I've lived the past 22 years in Asia, in Hong Kong and Singapore. And I've had a really exciting career analyzing the astronomical rise of Asia in the field of business strategy and competitiveness. And I just returned to the United States, to Boston, in August, just in time for the publication of my new novel.
Have you written anything before, or is this a first venture?
Oh, I've been a writer for decades, published, but in nonfiction. This is my first work of fiction.
Now, most people, when they think about Spanish history in the 13th, 14th, 15th centuries, they think more of Andalusia, of Toledo. And yet, this book is about the Jews in Aragon, which most people don't even know about. How did you become interested in this topic?
Aragon was an extremely important part, not just of Spain, but the Mediterranean and Europe in the 15th century. And what's sort of surprising to us now is that Aragon controlled Barcelona and Valencia, and through a sort of loose dynastic alliance, parts of the Mediterranean that stretched as far as Sicily and Naples. So Aragon was really wealthy due to trade. And traditionally, the Aragonese Sephardim, they were instrumental in managing the overland trade routes across the Pyrenees that linked Iberia to the rest of Europe. And by the 1400s, we see the rise of the sea trade and sea routes across the Mediterranean. So the traders in Aragon controlled a lot of this wealth. And this meant major wealth, major influence. And we see it in the Sephardic culture and presence in Aragon. For example, the Great Synagogue of Zaragoza, it is estimated to have had one of the largest congregations in all of Europe at the time. With estimates in the thousands of people. I've seen estimates of 2,000 to 3,000 people or even more. So Aragon was really diverse also in terms of the people who lived there and the religions. And I would say that, you know, in terms of the living together of people of different faiths, what we call la convivencia, it was among the most highly developed I've seen in all of Iberia. So here was this extraordinary city of Teruel in Aragon, where Jews, Muslims, and Christians were living side by side in fancy houses, along a major avenue, and they engage in real estate transactions with each other. And it's just amazing. So this is in my book.
But how did you become interested in this at all? Where did this interest in the Sephardim and in Spain come from?
I've been interested in Spain pretty much forever because my mother's family came from this really close-knit clan that went back generations in a very isolated part of Central America. I mean, in the middle of nowhere. And that meant that they were totally isolated for 400 years. And when I was growing up in Washington, D.C. in the 1970s, I mean, my mom was raising me with these incredibly strict rules, like, you know, don't ask why, you do this way, or you drop dead, sort of thing. Huh. And I didn't know at the time where they came from.
Can you give some examples of what sort of things?
Okay, my book is a lot about women, and actually I don't go into this, but a lot of it had to do when I came of age with hygiene. I mean, overall, a lot of it had to do with hygiene and household customs, and certain things just had to be done certain ways. I mean, there couldn't be any hairbrush within a mile of the kitchen or the dining room. The head had to be really covered or pulled back. And cutting fingernails, I mean, that was the biggest taboo. I mean, fingernails had to be cut and they couldn't, you know, just be let fly. They had to be carefully wrapped and carefully disposed of. And things when I came of age about how to wash my personal linens, I mean, I just knew that nobody in my social circle at school was being raised with these things. And I became really interested in knowing what they were about.
So what did your mother tell you? Did you ask her?
My mother spoke in riddles about it, amazing riddles. And since then, there's been a literature, an academic literature on the traditions and cultures of the conversos in Latin America. And that is typical. Because, you know, admitting to having Jewish faith and loyalties was, you know, penalized by death. These families evolved these very roundabout ways of signaling. And the actual revelation of Jewish heritage, the confirmation, was traditionally, it's hard for me to recount this, but I will. It was traditionally revealed upon death. And that's what happened in my case.
And of course, your mother's surname, Saavedra, is a very illustrious one because it's also the surname of Cervantes' mother.
Yes. Now, that's really interesting to me. I read in one source that his mother was something else, a different surname. I really don't know how Saavedra got there, but I will tell you that in our clan, the Saavedras had been there for 400 years, and they were colloquially known as Sefarditas. There was no question about that, because I only have about 9 surnames over 400 years of history. Then the aunties married a daughter to a cousin or a second cousin. And so the Saavedras in our family were of Sephardic origin.
This is all, everything that you're telling me is very, very typical of a crypto-Jews. We've just done several programs on crypto-Jews, and this sort of thing comes up again and again and again.
I like the story, and I like the fact, Linda, that it is corroborated by many other stories, mm-hmm. and it's evidence of it's one more data point in a set of points now, mm-hmm. that there's this whole culture of people who've been living like this.
Where in Central America were they from?
Panama.
Mm-hmm.
And you wonder, why Panama? Panama isn't very well known today except for the canal, but, you know, at the time that they arrived in Panama, it was the biggest city in the Americas.
Mm-hmm.
And the gold and silver from Peru, they were going across there. So it was a huge entrepot, mm-hmm. and people with money and influence were very attracted to it. By tradition, the family traded in emeralds.
So let's talk about the book.
Sure.
It's a novel, but something that impressed me very much about it is that it's extremely well researched. And I was wondering, especially since you were in the Far East, how did you go about doing the research? Because many of the secondary characters really existed, and other real people are mentioned. And you really did a lot of research. How long did it take, and how did you go about doing it?
Oh, good question. I write this novel when I was living in Singapore. It was entirely written in Singapore. And, well, partly I came to the novel with a lifelong sort of hoard of learning because I had taken Spanish literature and history at Harvard. I'd saved my books and my collection because I loved them so much, so I still had the ballads on my shelves. But yes, there was a lot of research that went specifically into the story, in particular those characters you mentioned. And I still believe in books, Linda. So for research, I had books shipped from Amazon and built up a wonderful collection of books in the tropics. The internet was also a great tool, but I would say that the one book that inspired me the most and the author academic to whom I owe the most is David Gitlitz, who is recently retired from the University of Rhode Island in Providence. And it's his book, Secrecy and Deceit, The Religion of the Crypto-Jews. This is a tremendous book to anybody who wants to look more deeply into it. And in that book, David not only discusses by theme, you know, the meanings of heaven and holidays and rituals and God to these conversos who are just going through a period of angst and confusion. And he does it on the basis of actual Inquisition testimony, that is what the people said when they were brought before the tribunals. And one of the wonderful things about his book is that in the end notes, he includes the original, be it in medieval Aragonese, Castilian, or Portuguese, and I can read those. So I was really sucked in when I was reading, you know, the words of those people. It was as if I heard their voices, and that seized my imagination. I wanted to bring these voices alive. I wanted their thoughts and their concerns and their beliefs to be heard today. And that's a major reason why I wrote the book.
Tell us about the title, Why Lamps?
I was inspired by the proverb, the soul of man is the lamp of God. And in the story, the main characters, each of them has an oil lamp, a traditional oil lamp. And each lamp is different. And each lamp gives us a glimpse into their inner selves, which was really, really fun to write and explore. And the lamp is also representative of the hope that endures across generations.
I found the characters very interesting because the protagonists are very intelligent and intellectual girls and women. And they have very profound, almost theological conversations, very religious, spiritual conversations. And something that surprised me, I guess, was that there are two young girls. Sarah is the narrator, and she, when it starts, she's, I think, 11. And Raina, who's her little sister, is only 5 years old and who seems to know an awful lot for a five-year-old. Are they based on real people? And how did you happen to create these characters?
That's a great question. I'm really glad you asked. Okay, there's been a lot of pushback on Raina being 5. So the latest thing is that Raina is now 7. But that doesn't change the fact that she's extraordinarily precocious. So, okay, this is very much a story about women. And in particular, thinking women. Women who are thinkers. Now, if we look at the great teachers of Judaism in the Middle Ages, they were all men. And correct me if I'm wrong, but to my knowledge, they are men.
Well, those are the ones we hear about anyway.
Exactly. You got it. They're the ones we hear about. Now, I'm with you. We know that from time to time, a little girl is born who is a spiritual prodigy and a genius. We know that they were born. Now, what would have happened to her if she'd been born in Spain and started to grow up just when the Inquisition came into her town? This really fascinated me. And that's the birth of the character Reina.
Well, one thing is, of course, that women didn't get the same kind of education that men got.
Of course. And so I based her intelligence on an example. You're totally right. And it's the example of the childhood precocity. Okay, just in terms of development, of the Ari, Rabbi Isaac Luria, mm-hmm. who was born about 50 years after this story, you know, in real life. And he was an incredible prodigy. I believe that his dad died when he was young, but all the other men who were involved in teaching him recognized his extraordinary insight. So I was inspired to think about a little girl who could read Hebrew with good understanding at the age of 7. And I was interested in what would have been the life of such a girl prodigy. How would her family members, I mean, come on, you're never a prophet in your own country, right? How would her family members have dealt with this kid? And also, faced with these horrible challenges of the arrival of the Inquisition, what would have been her spiritual response? Because she was a spiritual being. What would have been her spiritual response? What answer would she have come up with? And this is Reina in the book.
Something else that I found interesting was the relationship between the Jews and the conversos, because most of the people are, let's say, upper class people. They're wealthy. Mm-hmm. And it seems natural for the Jews to convert almost in order to maintain their social status and sometimes in order to move up in society also and to be accepted by the surrounding environment, I guess, the Christians. Can you tell us about this sort of interaction and did this really happen? In other words, was it common for people to convert not because they were afraid of the Inquisition, but just kind of to move up in society?
Absolutely. And you just put it really well. This is very much reflected in the primary historical evidence that Professor Gitlitz, you know, puts in his compendium. And in Aragon, with this incredible wealth and the rise of their economy and the rise of cities, there was so much wealth creation and there were so many opportunities, you know, opening up. And some of the wealthiest and most prominent Sephardic families, or certain branches of them, did convert in order to advance professionally and socially. I like to think in some cases it was just to be able to give, you know, the contribution to contribute to their town, to their society, the way that they were, you know, uniquely equipped to contribute. These are incredibly educated and capable men, right? Mostly. So that was definitely there. But we also have to remember that this was before the Inquisition entered Aragon. That wasn't a given. And so they really believed that they could have the best of both worlds. And one example of this was the chief magistrate whom King Ferdinand left in charge of a judicial administration in Aragon when he left to marry Isabel. And his name was Jaime de Montesa. There's an extraordinary historical incident surrounding him, which there isn't time to relate here. But that was something else that made me very interested in Aragon and in writing about it. And is also reflected in the story.
Were these conversos true conversos, or were they just sort of nominal conversos who continued to practice Judaism secretly? Because they did seem to continue to have a relationship with family members, let's say, who didn't convert.
Okay, that's a great question. And, you know, because history is so complex, it's dangerous to give a generalization. But for sure, leading individuals such as Jaime de Montesa honestly believed that a formal conversion to Christianity did not mean that he'd have to give up Judaism, so that he was a Christian when he was at work, and on the Shabbat he was a true faithful Jew reading his Torah with his beautiful white linen tablecloth. These touching details were captured by the inquisitors.
I'd like you to speak a little bit about the language, because the dialogues and the descriptions are very poetic. And you also include certain songs and poems. And I was wondering if they were translated from the original Spanish or if you wrote them yourself.
Well, you know that Spain has the most beautiful tradition of medieval ballads or romanceros. And the Sephardim were very much part of this tradition because, as we know, when they left Spain, they carried many of these ballads and songs with them. And that's why many of them survive to this day. And I wanted to transmit the beauty and the spirit of the ballads in my novel. So those are, you know, actual ballads. And I had a wonderful time translating them into English.
Are you working on anything now?
Well, right now I'm really busy with the launch of the Lamps of Albarracín in the United States and Spain. And I'm also hoping to bring it to more countries and to give it a presence in Israel and Latin America. For example, Mexico and Argentina. So I have a very exciting road of promotion and distribution ahead of me. And as for the next book, I mean, for me, writing a book is a matter of inspiration. I never planned to write this book. And when it came, I mean, it just was an amazing experience, all encompassing. So I guess you have to see.
Well, I think that the fact that it came out bilingually, it came out in Spanish and English at the same time, kind of gives you a whole world of practically of places that it can be launched, that people will want to read it.
Yeah, that was one of the reasons, because I believe that this story, you know, really belongs to the world, and it also belongs to the Spanish-speaking world. And if I had just written it in English, then a large part of that readership, you know, wouldn't have got it. So I'm just really happy to have it in two languages now.
Did you translate it yourself into Spanish?
That's funny. This is one of these hybrid processes where most of it came to me in English, but certain parts of it definitely came to me in Spanish. But because I am not trained to write literary Spanish, I'm not equipped to write a novel in Spanish. So what I did was I put together like Spanish instructions, which drove the translators nuts. But my feelings, my poetic and linguistic and emotional feelings about which words or phrases should be used for certain parts of each chapter. And as I finalized each chapter in English, we did the Spanish. Mm-hmm. So it was sort of side by side throughout. And what was really cool was that the Spanish edits influenced me so greatly that I changed the English, and sometimes the English edits would change the Spanish. And so what I think you have is really a book which is nourished in both languages, you know, by two languages, which is exciting.
Especially since you speak both, so you were able to understand both, even if you didn't feel equipped to be able to translate, but you could understand what was written in Spanish.
Oh, totally. I was over every single word, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, could we use this word? Could we use the other word? You know, I always came to me as this, you know. Why can we use this term? Why don't we use the other? It was an amazing process. And I'm really proud because it's part of my heritage. And I didn't want my book in Spanish just to be one of these translations that comes out after the fact, you know, mm-hmm. done by translators someplace else. No, this is just, you know, they are integrally me and also this incredible team that I had with me.
How long did the whole project take from the time you started researching until it's been published?
From the time I knew I was writing a novel, okay, 5 years. But the beginning of the research, that goes back before then, because this has been like a special interest of me my whole life. And even in my adult years, after my kids were out of diapers, you know, I was able to go back to researching on the internet, reading, following events and trends. And, you know, I got to say that this is a really exciting time in Aragon now because of the rediscovery and the celebration of their Sephardic culture. So their discoveries and festivals and families are returning, and I got really, really pulled into that, into the excitement of all of that.
That's happening a lot in different parts of Spain recently. Is there anything else you would like to add that we might have left out?
Yeah, well, I would like just to mention, so as to honor, two centers of Sephardic culture in Aragon, and a group without which I really couldn't have given the book the authenticity that it has. And those are Calatayud and Tarazona. In particularly, the Tarbut Sefarad of Calatayud has been extraordinarily generous in giving time and insight, just to give those wonderful details and the flavor that makes it come alive.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Well, that's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear from you. So please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is EnglishCorner@RadioSefarad.com. See you next week.